Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, January 3rd, 2019. South Sudan's military spokesman accuses the NAS of killing civilians.
About the massacre of 19 civilians and wounding of 8 others. The wounded are currently receiving medical treatment at Juba Military Hospital.
And a Sudanese opposition leader offers Sudanese protesters some organizational help.
We have no problem getting leadership. They haven't appointed a person to be the leader. They still are talking about collective leadership.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's military spokesman claims that anti-government forces have carried out what he terms a massacre in a village about 30 miles southwest of the capital, a claim that could not be verified by this program. General Lu Rui Kwang accused a rebel group led by General Thomas Cirillo of killing nearly 20 people. Waki Simon Mudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Speaking to journalists this evening in Juba, Major General Lulu Rui Kwang says fighters with the National Salvation Front, or NAS, killed 19 people last night between Gorom and Wonduruba areas of Jubek State.
It is with the deepest sorrow that the SPDF General Headquarters would like to announce to the people of South Sudan, the region and the international community about the massacre of 19 civilians and wounding of 8 others. The wounded are currently receiving medical treatment at Juba Military Hospital.
Among the dead were women, children, and elderly people, according to Kwang, who says the attacks were led by NAS General Kenyilo Brun. He says there was no fighting between government and rebel forces or between rival militia groups in the area when the killings took place. He says the South Sudan People's Defense Forces learned of the killings from intelligence sources who visited the area following a tip from several civilians. Kwang insists that NAS fighters led by General Thomas Cirillo are behind the incident and called on the ceasefire monitoring body, CITISAM, to investigate the matter.
Most likely, we are going to join forces with SPLAIO to protect this peace agreement. You know, it's a direct threat, not only to us, but it is a challenge to all the peace partners. We are trying to end the war, but it's very unfortunate that on the 2nd, between 2nd and 3rd of January 2019, the year we thought would be a year of peace, is that we had witnessed a major bloodshed. 19 civilians getting killed on a single night. This is very serious.
The alleged killings come 2 weeks later after government forces and NAS clashed in Yei River State, with both sides blaming each other for starting the fight. While Thomas Group signed the cessation of hostilities agreement in Khartoum with the other parties in August, NAS refused to sign the revitalized deal, saying it fails to address some of the key causes of the South Sudan conflict. Suba Samuel, spokesman for the National Salvation Front, denies his group killed civilians and says he was surprised to hear the government's latest allegations.
We know very well that this is not the first time that the regime in Juba has killed people in that area, But the shortest way of doing all this thing is to tarnish the image of National Salvation Front, and we are 100% sure that this thing has been committed by the regime forces there to tarnish the image of National Salvation Front. We are not responsible of all these atrocities. However, we are preparing a press release to deny all this, to condemn it, and provide some evidences for that effect.
Suba claims the area in which the killings allegedly took place is being controlled by heavy armed government forces. South Sudan in Focus was unable to independently verify the allegations in this story. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Yeah. Sudan President Omar al-Bashir has ordered an investigation into what he calls recent events after 2 weeks of violent protests against his nearly 30 years of reign in power as he tries to tamp down widespread outrage over the country's economic crisis. The state news agency reported this week that Bashir has ordered Justice Minister Mohamed Ahmed Salem to lead the investigation. No other details about that probe were announced. More than 20 protesters have been killed so far, according to various media outlets. Amnesty International says the number is actually much higher than that. The Sudan protests sprang up from ordinary citizens and quickly spread across the country with no organization from opposition groups. Jibril Ibrahim, chairman of the Justice and Equality Movement, says many leaders of various opposition groups are offering what he's calling a collective leadership to the protesters. He claims that Islamists in Sudan who have been backing President Bashir have now also joined the protests and are calling for change in Sudan.
Each group got its own leadership. The Sudan Corps got its leader, Sadiq al-Mahdi, and of course it got its presidential council where all the major blocs are represented in. And then we have this Sudan Consensus Fund. They have Farouk Abu-Issa, their leader, but of course the major party in that one is the Communist Party, and then the Baathists and the rest of the groups. And then you have the trade unions that led by the doctors and the lawyers, the bar association group. So I think we have no problem getting leadership. They haven't appointed a person to be the leader. They still are talking about collective leadership, but at some point we will have the right person leading the whole thing.
What is your reading on President Bashir's speech last week? He seemed to be offering an olive branch to the protesters.
I don't really think he said anything new. He first tried to give a rationale for the police, if you listen to what he said to the police forces, that killing people is the right thing to keep them alive, or to keep the rights alive, the rest alive. So Bashir is actually they're telling the police to kill more people, and that's one dangerous thing. The other thing, he kept saying the same words, the same sentences for the last 10 years without having any real change on the ground. And now Bashir lost trust. Nobody trusts him in whatever he says. That's his major problem, I think, because the people lost trust on him. And unless he follows his words, his actions, his deeds, nobody is going to take whatever he says seriously.
What about his political power base, the Islamists? What are they saying? They have been backing President Bashir for all these years. What are they saying about these recent developments in Khartoum?
Well, I don't think that Islamists are now happy with him. And they ask the military does. Also, the Islamists think he's a liability. He's no more a credit to them. So, and because there are differences among themselves, and some among them are not happy with him, I think that is how things are moving. Some of them are joining these demonstrations and pushing for change. So it is not a solid body right now. The Islamists are not a solid body that is supporting or standing behind the Bashir family. I do doubt that he got that support he used to have in the past.
That is Jibril Ibrahim, chairman of the Justice and Equality Movement in Sudan, speaking with my colleague John Tanza from Paris earlier this week. The economy in Sudan is a crisis that has been decades in the making, according to the Enough Project. The group says years of rapid depreciation of the currency, shortages of essential commodities, and a failure in the public health and education sectors are the result of 30 years of economic mismanagement. Suleiman Baldo, a senior advisor at the Enough Project, tells Ayan Deng Bior, there are steps the government can take to repair its economy.
One major reason for the economic difficulties that Sudan is facing today is an overexpenditure on the military and security sector. The official rate of expenditure on the military and security sector in the 19th in the 2018 budget is above 86% of the national, budget, while the sectors of education, health, industry, and agriculture, all these key and major four sectors essential for the health of the economy and the social and human development of the Sudanese people, are allocated a meager 5.2% of the national budget collectively for all of them. So it gives you the kind of wrong-headed priorities that the Sudanese government allocates to the productive and social sectors and, the privileging of the security and intelligence sector at the cost of everything else. And that is why this crisis is indeed self-inflicted.
So let's bring it down to an individual level. How is Sudan's economy impacting everyday people?
Of today, the official rate of exchange that is determined by a new body called the Market Makers Committee, consisting of banks manager and exchange bureau managers and couple of experts, is in the range of 4.5 pounds to the dollar. In the black market, the rate is now 50 plus to the dollar and 60 Sudanese pound to $1 by check. So the gap has never been addressed because Sudan has failed to address, the discrepancy of its foreign exchange policy, which maintains multiple rates of exchange and instead creates this mechanism which stops short of completely floating the Sudanese pound.
Now, with self-infliction comes self-correction. Can you take us briefly through some key things that the Sudan government can do to correct the mistakes of the past?
President Omar al-Bashir appointed a new cabinet on September 14th, supposedly to address the economic crisis and conduct correction of macroeconomic policies that will end the economic crisis. However, when you look at the actual decisions and implementation of these decisions by the new cabinet, it tells you that, there is no seriousness, there is no political will to really get to the bottom of the structural causes of the crisis.
That is Suleiman Baldo, a senior advisor at the Enough Project. He was speaking to Ayan Dangbior from New Jersey. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. South Sudanese farmers say pastoralists are still posing a problem. Find out where when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
when you are upset, would you rather be alone or with others?
I'd rather be alone, because sometimes being with people demands a lot from someone's self.
When you stress up, there's no need of being alone, because when you are with others, at least they can advise you.
When I'm upset, actually, being alone is not a good thing. So at least I have to associate with my colleague and I end up releasing that anger from me.
I prefer being alone when I'm upset, yeah, because at least when I'm alone, I regain some humor when at least I go in public, I can talk with someone now. But when I'm still pissed, I can't talk to anyone.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Some residents of Magui County in Torit State say some cattle keepers from the greater Upper Nile region are still grazing their animals in the area in violation of two presidential decrees. One farmer says the cattle have destroyed crops in his village, leaving farmers and those who depend on them at risk of food insecurity. Winnie Serino has the story for VOA from Torit.
Lagu Joseph, a farmer in Agoro Payam, says more than 6 head of cattle are grazing in the villages of Owin Kibu, Agoro, Nyolo, Omeo, Ayi, and Pagere Payam. He says he planted cassava and simsim on his 2-acre plot of land this season, but most of the crops have been destroyed by cattle.
My cassava were destroyed, and even the crops, some of us, we did not go to exile. And some of the community who left the place, they went to exile, and refugees come. So by the time when they went, they left cassava in the garden. But when they're coming back, they found everything was not there, been destroyed. The compound were being turned as a grazing area.
Joseph says the destroyed crops will make residents food insecure. Ochol Bosco, one of the area's youth, says he worries that grazing cattle in the area will affect the fertility of the soil, but most people do not want to confront the cattle keepers.
Grazing cattle in our land is already a disaster to us because our soil is going to be destroyed and the crops that we are relying on will not be there. And then another thing also, when you look at the character of these cattle keepers, they are not friendly, they are hostile. So therefore, for us to interact together with them is really difficult.
Joseph agrees that the pastoralists, some of whom are armed, pose a security threat to the local residents.
It's affecting the returnees who are now coming. Some of them have a fear because most of those people who are coming, they're holding weapons. They're having guns. Then they're threatening life of people. And even some building, their iron seat was removed. And some part of Chombara and Goro Unity, and some of them we suspect they are looting some of the resources there. They are cutting tree.
Joseph accuses the pastoralists of illegally exploiting natural resources like timber from the area. Ochola Boskoringa, the Magui County Commissioner, says a majority of the pastoralists came from Jonglei and Terekeka State when fighting flared up in Juba and spread to other parts of the equatorial region. That forced many residents to flee their homes and seek refuge in the neighboring countries. He says some of the soldiers undergoing training in Owin Kibu Military Training Center own cattle as well and have refused to send the cattle away, claiming they need permission from the Defense Ministry.
The first group that was tackled, they moved. They are now in Jongole. But now those who are now, they did not go because due to some delay in their movement, sometimes with a lot of complaint. That's why up to now they are occupying the area. But still, we are talking to them. We also engage them that we don't want them to be in the area. They have to move.
Torit State Governor Tobiolo Alberio Oromo says by now most pastoralists have returned their cattle to their states of origin. He says only a few undisciplined pastoralists continue to let their cattle graze in the area.
It is just a matter of a continuous implementation of the presidential decree. We are continuing to remove. As I am talking to you now, our forces that are tasked to remove the remaining cattle, they are doing their work. But soon we are going to disarm all the cattle keepers because those cattle keepers are a source of insecurity to the farmers.
More than 3.5 years ago, President Salva Kiir issued a decree ordering the return of all cattle from former central, western, and eastern equatorial states to their home state after scores of farmers complained to government officials about the destruction of their crops. In October 2017, Kiir issued another decree ordering pastoralists to immediately vacate the equatorial region or risk being forced by the soldiers. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Torit.
Amid tensions in the neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo, the Catholic Bishops' Conference held a press conference today to call attention to voting problems that could call into question the outcome of the recent presidential election that had already been delayed for 2 years. In addition, the DRC's Independent National Election Commission, CENI, announced it may have to postpone publication of provisional results scheduled for January 6th. Our colleague Anastasie Toothias is in Kinshasa and spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis about what was revealed at today's press conference, as well as what the mood is like on the ground.
Well, basically what was said was that the observers gave recommendations. I mean, they gave their observations of the process and what they saw and what they noted. And they ended with recommendations for the government, for the CENI, you know, the organization that organizes the election, and to the candidates. So to the government, they suggest strongly that people who committed violence get sued, to take all measures to do anything and everything necessary so that security is effective where people vote, usually people in the polling centers. And to the CENI, the organization that organized the election, the recommendations were to make sure that the access was made freely and easily to observers and witnesses to the polling centers, and to make sure that voters are protected. And to the candidates, one of the main recommendations was to stop, to refrain themselves from publishing early results, and to refrain from being over triumphant once the results are out.
Now, did they say anything about the postponement of the publication of provisional results for January 6th?
They did not. But yesterday, I interviewed Vital Kamere, who is the campaign director of Antoine Tshisekedi, one of the main contenders, one of the main candidates. And I asked him about the election on Sunday, and he said, well, I'm not sure they will actually take place, the results on Sunday. And he said he was not sure the results would be published on Sunday, that more than likely they would happen on Monday or Tuesday. And he said that his camp didn't care. All he cared about was that the result of the election reflects what the voters decided, what the voters chose.
And with that, what are people saying about this election? What's the mood on the ground?
People in the streets, and I speak with them daily, tell me that if the two names they are awaiting, meaning the two names being Tshisekedi and Fayulu, if one of these two is not the winner, there will be blood in the street. And this is verbatim. I'm not, you know, trying to interpret. That's what I hear daily.
Is the internet still down?
Oh, yes. Internet is still down. And some people are saying that it won't be back until after the new president is presented to the Congolese people. Some people say not before the 15th or the 16th, but Lambert Mende, Minister of Communication, said that he would do his best to ask, you know, the authorities to put the internet back. So we don't know.
Also, what is being said of those million or so Congolese who did not get to vote because of various reasons with the Ebola outbreak, conflict, and just logistical problems?
Some people in these areas still voted. Even though their vote didn't count, they still woke up very early in the morning and did the ceremonial, like, did as if their voices, you know, would be taken into account. That tells you how eager people were to vote. There's a lot of anger and disappointment, but also a feeling of helplessness. Once you express your anger and you realize that nothing is changing and your voice is not heard, what do you do?
That was reporter Anastasie Toothias in Kinshasa speaking today to VOA's Kim Lewis. Worried about a Boko Haram resurgence, Niger says it has killed more than 280 of the extremists over the past week with air and land strikes near the Nigerian border. Defense Minister Kala Mutari said in Parliament last month that Boko Haram was able to reinvigorate itself by overrunning Nigerian military bases, snatching supplies and weapons. The Komadugu Yobi River normally serves as a physical barrier between Niger and Nigeria, but its waters usually recede at this time of year, raising concerns about cross-border attacks. In a statement that aired on television, the Niger Defense Ministry said airstrikes have killed about 200 Boko Haram extremists, while its troops killed 87 more. The Niger Army says it also seized 8 canoes and 2 rocket launchers, as well as assault weapons, ammunition, and vehicles. West African leaders met in November to discuss strategy amid a rash of Boko Haram attacks in the Lake Chad area. We turn to neighboring Kenya now, where schools reopened today for a new term, even while teachers continue to pressure the government to address their grievances over poor working conditions, low pay, and irregular transfers. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Kiama reports.
A court order issued yesterday suspended a planned teacher strike that threatened to paralyze learning activities countrywide as children resumed classes for the first term. A judge from the Labor Relations Court directed members of the Kenya National Union of Teachers and their employer, the Teachers Service Commission, to hold mediation talks. But union officials remained categorical that all the issues raised must be addressed. Wycliffe Omucheyi is the chair of the Kenya National Union of Teachers.
We are not going to cede any ground on the issues that we raised. The onus is upon the Teachers Service Commission to ensure that those 4 issues, ranging from promotions, delocalization, TPAD, and teacher progression, are adequately addressed by the Teachers Service Commission.
Earlier, the government had termed the call for the teachers' strike illegal. Amina Mohamed is Kenya's Education Cabinet Secretary.
And the schools that all belong to government are ready and prepared to receive our learners. And the learners and their parents are also ready to report to school.
The court ruling brought some reprieve to millions of Kenyan parents who looked forward to having their children back to school after a long December holiday. Wilson Sosion is the Secretary General of the Kenya National Union of Teachers.
We want to give a clear account blow by blow. We couldn't even discuss any of the items because they have demonstrated blatant disregard. The intention to sack teachers in the event of a strike. And if you commit yourself to a conciliation process, you don't send mixed signals.
Meanwhile, the court has stopped the Teacher Service Commission from transferring more than 3,000 teachers until February this year, to await the outcome of the talks. Lydia Nzomo is the chairperson of the Teachers Service Commission.
In readiness for the first term program, as I have said, teachers will be available to attend to all learners.
A spot check by VOA in Nairobi found that several schools had resumed learning activities by this morning. At the same time, Kenya has announced plans to roll out a new competence-based curriculum in all primary schools starting this term. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Selfie Remix by Kofi Olomide.
Jean-François Ndengue.
Hey!
Vincent Gomez,
Chuma, Alex, Chuma, 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 Chuma,
Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma, Chuma
We've been listening to Kofi Olomide with a song Selfie Remix. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles this evening. If you'd like to share a comment about something you've heard on the show, you can find us on Twitter with our handle at VOA South Sudan. If you're planning to be out of Juba and can't tune us in on an FM radio station, you can still listen to us on shortwave. Our frequencies are 11850 kilohertz, 13865 kilohertz, and 15180 kilohertz. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.